It's time for Broadway Names with Julie James. Broadway Names with Julie James. Where Patty and Mandy and Phoebe and Sheena talk Roxy and Velma and Shay and Davina. Witches and Newsies and Mormons and Spiders start out as strangers and end up confiders. That's Broadway Names.
Hi, I'm Patty LuPone. Broadway Names
with Julie.
With Julie James.
Julie James.
Hey, I'm Raul Esparza.
It's Hugh Jackman.
Gosh, Julie, I'm telling you everything.
I love it.
Yeah.
It's Broadway Names with Julie James in the studio at SiriusXM on Broadway. And I am so happy to have finally a moment come true that we've been talking about, commiserating about for a few months now. It's super producer Hal Luftig. Hello.
Hi.
Welcome.
Oh my God. I am thrilled to be here. I am like, I wish the viewers could see me. I'm jumping up and down. I am so excited to be here with you. You are like on my bucket list. Do you remember? I was thinking about this today. Do you remember when Kinky Boots had been nominated? And they do that press day,
yes,
which is sort of like speed dating,
yes,
for press.
That's a very good descriptor.
You go from booth to booth to booth to,
yes,
booth, and people interview you.
The day after the Tony nominations,
yes,
there's a huge press event at a hotel in the heart of Midtown, and all of the Tony nominees from every category all gather with members of the press, and you're right, it is speed dating.
I love that
analogy.
Well, first of all of the nominees are there. So, mm-hmm, you're seeing all of your friends and you're hugging and you're kissing and you're congratulating. You know, you're still trying to absorb,
yeah,
the nominations.
Because it's like 24 hours later. So it's
or less,
still really,
right. Yeah, it's
real.
Still really new. You've spent that whole morning or day, you know, congratulating, figuring out who did get nominated, who didn't, mm-hmm, get nominated, all of that stuff. And then you meet the press and they start asking, you know, questions. How does it feel? And you know, you haven't even processed all of those things. And now you're in front of the press. But I'll never forget, we were speed dating, sort of, and they took me to you and they said, Hal, this is Julie James. And I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. Because I've wanted to meet you for so long.
I can't believe it took this long.
Me neither.
I'm so happy that it's happening now.
It's like all good dates. You know, you have to go through a lot of bad dates to get to,
ooh,
the good date. This is a great date.
So we're dating, Hal. Where's there's a lot of dating great, analogies going on. I'm not upset about that.
Me neither.
My other big memory was talking about Kinky Boots. It was Tony night. And we were in the wee hours at the Carlisle Hotel. My favorite night of the year. And especially spending it at the Carlisle is so special. And you were there and you had the Tonys, yep, in your hand, and then the New York Times was showing up because it was, I mean, I'm not exaggerating.
No,
it
not.
Was wee
you
hours.
Made me cry.
Oh.
You made me cry. And I'm sorry I didn't bring it because we're on the radio. No one would believe me anyway. So I did bring it. The photo, I have a favorite photo,
oh,
of Billy and I holding the Billy Porter and I holding the New York Times, mm-hmm, that says Kinky Boots dances to the top. But right before they took that photo, I ran into you and you were hugging me and telling me how happy you are, and I was still so happy to meet you that I started crying. I started getting old. And they took this photo, and if you look at my eyes, it's like I'm all moist and teary eyed.
Oh.
And that was because of you. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah,
well,
I have to get you a copy of that photo.
I would love that.
Yeah.
Well, we are talking to producer Hal Luftig, whose most recent show is Kinky Boots. You have some new shows coming up that,
yeah,
I'm excited to talk about too. But congratulations, because Kinky Boots was recently in the headlines again because the show recouped in like 30 weeks.
Yes, 30
incredible.
Weeks.
Incredible. Especially, yeah, when you consider most Broadway shows. I mean, it's something like 70% or higher don't recoup at all.
Right.
So this is not a business that I'm always curious about this.
Right.
And I'm so happy to have you to ask. You know, no one's really going into this to, you know, make a gold mine.
You know, but here's the thing that people don't, beyond the life of Broadway,
mm-hmm,
shows have a big life that people don't, I don't know that they really reckon into the fact. For example, after a show ceases performing on Broadway, there could be a national tour. Mm-hmm. There are foreign productions, of which there are many. Mm-hmm. There's what they call stock and amateur, which is when high schools and church groups and things do those shows. For example, I was just told that this past year, 2013, over 4,000 productions of Legally Blonde were going on worldwide. Now, I only say that because that's another source of income for those investors who put money into the Broadway company. So there are many times that a show may leave Broadway unrecouped, but it will eventually because of all this other, what they call ancillary income.
Yeah. Oh, that is so fascinating. Yeah. And just so that you are all clear, SiriusXM family, on who we're talking to, Hal Luftig is behind some of our favorite memories and shows. Caitlin, who is behind our soundboard, can vouch for me that I never use notes. Very, very rarely. Mm-hmm. I had to print this out. And it's 2 pages from the fabulous Internet Broadway database. Get there to IBDB and look at this list that I can't even. We'll take up the whole show just listing these shows. The most recent revival of Evita. Mm-hmm. That is also on
that
a national tour right now.
True, right? Yes, it
Catch
is.
Me If You Can. I adored that show. Love Mark Shaman and Scott Whitman are very dear to me. Come Fly Away with the wonderful Karine Plantidy is in After Midnight right now. And she's just one of the most fascinating, captivating dancers.
Amazing.
Not going in chronology, you also did Moving Out. So you did the 2 Twyla Tharp.
The 3. You have to take the ones that work with the ones that don't. I did The Times They Are Changing.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. That's on here too. Yeah. The revival of West Side Story, All My Sons, Legally Blonde. We just mentioned Whoopi. Oh my gosh. Thoroughly Modern Millie, Seussical, Taller Than a Dwarf, Annie Get Your Gun revival from 1999. High Society, Diary of Anne Frank, Play On, The King and I, the 96 revival, Moon Over Buffalo, Angels in America. So, this is a range
Can
that
I
we're
tell
talking
you something?
About.
When you read that list, I'm like looking around like, who is she
who
talking
about? Who is she talking
who is
about?
She wow. I want to, who are you talking?
One of my really important early memories from, from the 90s, Secret Garden. I just wore that cast recording out because I wasn't in New York yet. Jelly's Last Jam. But if we go to the beginning of the list, we have the revival of MAME starring the great Angela Lansbury, and you are listed as production assistant.
I was a graduate student at Columbia University in their arts management program, which I'm proud to say that when I started that program, it was a 2-year program. And I went to the then dean and I said, there is so much to learn that you can do. And you had to write a thesis, too. Mm-hmm. There was no way I could do that in 2 years. So it was from that jumping off point that that's now a 3-year program because of that. So when I was in the program, one of the great things about that program was they allowed you to intern or do observerships in whatever area you wanted to. Well, I wanted to do in everything. So I interned at the Mitch Lee Company, which was producing the then revival of MAME, and they put me on as a production assistant, and it was great.
Oh my gosh.
I still remember it was great. Ugh. I did everything from get coffee for Miss Lansbury to try and find rehearsal props to, scour for a certain color pantyhose. I did it all. It was just,
wow.
It was heavenly.
That
it was
is
absolutely heaven. She was the nicest person. And in fact, fast forward like 3 years ago, so we're talking years later, and we were at some gala, and I went up to her and I introduced myself again, and I said, I'm sure you don't remember me. And she said, of course I remember you.
Oh my God.
Now, whether
goodness.
She did or not, I don't know.
Who
but
cares?
Ms. Lansbury.
Right answer.
Right. But Ms. Lansbury, there you go.
Stuff
that life is made of, right?
You got that right. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I have so many questions for producer Hal Luftig, but let's do a little celebrating. I love that we got a little nugget of how you started out in this business. business. We've got so much more ground to cover. But because we really officially met surrounding the crazy success of Kinky Boots, I'm going to celebrate with one of the most celebratory closing numbers that I can think of in recent years. I just love the way this sends everyone out on such a high note for the evening. This is Raise You Up from Kinky Boots.
Yes.
Are you saying that you are actually available?
Yes.
And you still like girls?
Yes.
Oh. Carry on!
Feed your fire to take you higher. We'll light you up like a live wire. Celebrate you to elevate you. When you struggle to stand, we'll take a helping hand.
Look out below!
Just be.
gentlemen, and those who have yet to make up their minds, as people all over the world clamor for Kinky Boots! It's time for us to get back to work. But before we go, we would like to leave you with the Price and Simon secret to success.
All right, now, we've all heard of the 12-step program, have we not? Yes, but what you can do in 12, I want you to know that we all can do in 6. Ow! And it goes like this.
Pursue the truth.
Come on, come on.
Learn something new.
The 2013 Tony-winning Best Musical, and I'm here with producer Hal Luftig, who not only produced that show, but so many of our musical theater favorites and plays, too. Don't want to leave those out.
No.
But Legally Blonde and Seussical and the great Twyla Tharp trio of Broadway shows and so much more. So, Hal, for people who do not know, because we have people of all different tastes and mm-hmm. comfort levels with their familiarity of Broadway, what is a Broadway producer? What do you do?
I love that question. You know, and can I get back to you on that? When I, no. I just thought,
well, it's a good question because I've found in the various mediums, you know, we have producers here that do something completely different from what you do. Movie producers do something completely different.
Right.
TV producers do something different. So for specifically a Broadway producer.
You know, people ask me that all the time. And what I like to say is a Broadway producer is either like a CEO of a company or the owner of a sports team.
Mm.
Usually they're the person at the top. They hire the director, you know, which would be the sports team manager.
Sure.
They then hire, you know, the players and the other personnel. And I think a good producer allows those people to do their jobs. But ultimately, you know, a producer oversees everything.
Mm-hmm.
And once a show is actually up and running, and once the creative part of it is over, you know, getting it on its feet and running, then a producer really is about the continual on day-to-day maintenance and running of the show. And that could be everything from advertising to marketing to whatever issues come up. Sometimes there's cast replacement.
Sure.
Sometimes, you know, you're sort of all a producer of shows are their father, mother, you know, nurse, muse, babysitter. It's all rolled into one.
And yeah.
Over the years, I have never cease to be amazed when something comes across my desk and my stock answer is like, I went to college for this. But you have to deal with it. You just have to, you know, you have to sort of deal with it.
Yeah.
Whether it be some kind of personality issue,
mm-hmm.
you know, someone's not getting along with somebody and you're like, wait a sec.
Yeah.
This is a $13.5 million. What am
I'm
I doing?
Not a therapist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Or maybe you are.
Well, on some parts, sometimes you are.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's no real clear cut definition, just like as a CEO mm-hmm. or a sports team owner, you know, stuff comes across the desk and you just have to kind of deal with it.
Yeah.
But I think a good producer allows the people that he hires to do their job.
I love that.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah, you hire the best people and then
let them go wild and let them do it. I always, you know, there's many, 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 many producers of different stripes in this business, and
mm-hmm.
you know, every so often you hear a story about someone who's getting in somebody else's, you know, trying to a producer being a director or a director trying to be a producer, and you're like, whoa, wow,
yeah, you know? Where's your lane? lane.
Yeah, everyone, exactly. Everyone your lane. Do what they're supposed to, and we'll all, you know, and we'll all, this will be great.
Yeah.
Exactly. Where's your lane? Right. Yeah.
Well, I've been thinking about it a lot because I recently read this incredible book called Song of Spider-Man by Glenn Berger, who was the original writer of Julie Taymor's concept for that show. And it is so fascinating, not just because of what happened with that show in particular, which was so, you know, rife with bad luck and unfortunate situations galore, but it's also a fascinating look at the mechanics of how a show goes from wandering around as an idea and a concept in someone's head to physically taking the stage. And it's a long journey. It was like something like 6 years even before they hit all the trouble. So
At least,
in the average show, you're working on a couple of new shows right now. Tell us a little bit about what you have coming up that hasn't hit the boards yet.
Well, first of all, I just want to stop for a second and just say this is why I love being here with you. And this is why I've always loved listening to you, because you are so informed and you are so, you know, up on things, and you do it in this way. Even when I listen to you on the radio, it's like, she's excited about it. I love that. So I just had to like,
Thank you.
Pause button and say that.
That means a lot. Passion is...
I'm still jumping up and down. But shows take a long, long time. Mm-hmm. Partly, it's the creative part of it that takes a long time. You know, figuring out who's going to do it, who's going to direct it, who's going to design it. And I'm a kind of producer that I love the development process. I know when we were doing, for example, Legally Blonde, we would do half an act. We'd have four scenes, and we would go into a studio, and Jerry Mitchell, the director choreographer, would call some of his friends and say, listen, how about you just come in and, you know, read? And there were a couple of readings. I was Elle Woods. It was, you know, hilarious.
Wow.
Just to hear the dialogue.
Yes,
because I think it's so imperative for authors to hear their work outside of their head. To hear somebody else say it is so informative, because they suddenly hear, oh my God, that joke wasn't funny, or oh, that storyline isn't clear, or, you know, oh, that line doesn't fit with the, you know, with the song that's coming up. So we did that many, many times, but that takes time.
Sure.
That takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
Then once you have all of that, there's all, you know, the scheduling is horrible too. And in
a
case like Spider-Man, you know, Julie Taymor is so busy and, you know, trying to figure out all the mechanics of that show in particular. It takes a long time. I know when I was doing Evita, we needed to wait a full year for Michael Grandy. He was so busy at the time. He was the director of the Donmar Warehouse. That man scheduled like coffee breaks, you know, in his schedule.
Wow.
That's how busy he was. And so we had to wait a whole year just to get on his radar to start the developmental process of Evita.
Yeah.
Then you have to wait for a theater. That could take, you know, in Broadway, real estate's everything. And that could take, you know, anywhere up from a year plus.
Yeah.
A star, if you have one. You know, we, in the case of Evita, Ricky Martin was, he had a year's tour already booked. So, you know, you add all those things up, all of a sudden, it's 6 years of your life.
And
you
go, many moving parts.
Exactly. What did that happen? Why did that happen? And you don't know, you know, you're 6 years older.
Right.
It's like, oh my God, I started this, I was 20.
Yeah.
And that's, it does. It takes a really long time.
Yeah.
Kinky Boots was fairly fast, and that was 4.5.
And that's on the quick side.
And that was on the very quick side.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, because, you know, Harvey Fierstein kept, you know, going, come on, you know, let's go, you know, and God love him.
Yeah.
You know,
thank goodness he did.
Yeah.
Or as Cyndi Lauper would say, thank God I answered the phone that day when I was doing the dishes.
She'd still be doing the dishes. You know, God love our sin. She'd still be doing the dishes.
Incredible.
Know? Yeah.
Well, that was a great reuniting of Jerry Mitchell. For Kinky Boots and who you worked with on Legally Blonde. Give us that number again. How many productions of Legally Blonde?
There were, in 2013, there were 4,000.
4,000
productions.
In
fact, this is just a funny little aside. I had just come back from Vienna. My husband is a psychiatrist, and there was a World Psychiatric Conference in Vienna. So I said, ooh, I'm going.
Yeah.
And luck as have it, they were doing a production of Natürlich Blondes. And when I got there, I know I'm game for anything. And when I arrived in Vienna, I discovered a local production of Catch Me If You Can, Das Musical.
Whoa.
And we went to see that too. I'm telling you, you have not lived until you have heard a show you know so well you can do the whole script in your sleep.
Yeah.
In a completely foreign language that you don't speak.
That is incredible. I do have a couple of little gems tucked away on this channel. I have a Japanese Rent. I have a Swedish Annie Get Your Gun. You know, sometimes the reason you just said. It's just kind of fun sometimes.
I
won't treat you with that right now, but I will treat you with music from Legally Blonde. Think about the 4,000 different productions that went on this year alone. And it ain't over yet, kids. Legally Blonde.
All of this time I planned I'd be patient and you would love me again. You'd come to respect my mind and at last you'd find you could love me again. And I have turned my whole world upside down, trying not to let you go. Watching you walk away, it's like a fatal blow.
Whoa!
Is that my name up on that list? Does someone know that I exist? Is this a mistake? Am I even awake? Pinch me now to make sure. Ah! Yes, that's my name in black and white. Maybe I'm doing something right. Whoa! I feel so much better than I've been a pest, but I guess my best was not working with you. But looks like I found a cure, and I so look forward to working with you.
What? Working with who?
Hey, remember when we spent spring break in the hot tub every night?
Every night.
We said nothing else could ever feel so right.
Well, this might
singing my name up on that list.
Blonde, one of Hal Luftig's musicals. That was a big claim to I don't remember. It's kind of feels like that was one of the first, you know, kind of big movie properties that we had coming in. That wasn't really so done back then, was
it? It was 2007.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was interesting. People back then, when it was coming in, there was a lot of, you know, skepticism about it because it was so tied to a star. And I think the thing when these movies become stage musicals, I think the thing to crack, the nut to crack, is what makes them theatrical? Mm-hmm. What is it that's different from the film?
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Legally Blonde, I very much wanted to tell that story of how girls do not have to dumb themselves down to get the guy. I didn't know that. As I told you just a little earlier ago, my husband is a psychiatrist, mm-hmm. and we saw the film. Mm-hmm. That how this came to be was we saw the film like everyone else, and I had seen the film, and then a group of friends want to go to the movies one night, and they all chose Legally Blonde, and you know how you don't want to be the only one say, yeah. oh, I saw that film. Yeah. So I thought, it's cute enough, I'll go see it again.
Yeah.
And seeing it the second time, knowing what was coming, it freed me up to start thinking, wow, this really has an arc of a musical. Mm-hmm. It's about a character who starts in one place, thinks she knows what her journey's going to be, mm-hmm. ends the story in a different place, and along the way teaches the people that she meets things about, you know, themselves too. I mean, think about it. Mame, Dolly, all the great, you know, like sort of heroines. They start in one place, they end in another place, and along the way, all the different characters they meet change too.
Right.
And when we were leaving the theater that night, that's when, you know, Stuart started telling me about this phenomenon that I didn't know about. I mean, you must, but I didn't. That somewhere around the age of, you know, 10, 12, you know, girls develop faster than boys.
Sure.
Sorry, guys. It's just the truth.
They do. It's just the truth.
They do. And somewhere around 10, 11, 12, 13, when they kind of discover, you know, the social pressures, boys, things mm-hmm. like that, they stop being, you know, intelligent. They fear that they're going to be ostracized mm-hmm. for being the smart one.
Mm-hmm.
So it is actually a phenomenon called dumbing themselves down, which initially was sort of one of the impetuses of having all girls schools because
really?
Yeah, they didn't have the boy factor
oh,
there.
Oh, interesting.
So when he told me that, I thought, that's the story yeah. I want to tell. Here's this girl, if you think about it, smart enough to get into Harvard Law.
Right.
And she's going there for what? The guy. A jerk of a guy, no
right.
less. And I thought, I have got to tell that story because, and God is my witness, one day I heard walking up the aisle, a grandmother, must have been a grandmother with her little granddaughter, saying, you know, see, Janie or whatever her name was, you can be smart and still be popular.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought,
There.
We did our job. But that's, you know, that's everything, you know, I want to say.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that there's that kind of inspiration behind
yeah.
it, rather, because I think, you know, there can be a perception. This is why I'm really excited to share our conversation with our listeners, because there can be that perception of like, you know, someone just spun a wheel and was like, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Mrs. Doubtfire,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
or whatever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
it's like,
well, unless you do that. And I, you know, that's when I think that those things usually don't work.
Mm hmm.
That's when they usually don't work. You can feel it. You need to, why? What is the story you're telling? Why on stage?
Mm-hmm.
What is it that the stage version is bringing,
yeah.
you know, to this? And in our version, you know, they sort of glossed over, going back to Legally Blonde, you know, when she gets into Harvard, they sort of glossed over. She made a video. She
mm-hmm.
made, you know, we were very, very adamant that you saw Elle study. You
yeah.
saw it, and
yeah.
you saw the parties going around her,
mm-hmm.
and you saw her being tempted, and you saw, you know, her girlfriend in the sorority saying, you know, no, you're not going to the keg party,
right.
you're going to study,
right?
You know, instead of swimming in a pool, and you know, I mean,
yeah.
the film was fun, and you know, I'm
Absolutely.
Not knocking the film at all. Listen, God
yeah.
knows, but we were very, very adamant that we were going to show how hard she worked
mm-hmm.
to get where she was.
I love that.
Yeah,
I love
yeah.
that. We
yeah.
do that here. We try to share, you know, with the young audience members that just see someone on a reality show
yeah.
and, you know, by hearing from people in the business and artists about how much hard work it is, and it's
right.
eight shows a week, and
yeah.
I have to train, and I have to save my voice, and
right.
I have to not go out at night, and all of that. So
yeah.
it's important that
yeah.
that young people know that.
Yeah.
We're
Very
talking
true.
With producer Hal Luftig about some of our favorite shows that, but I also want people to hear about your producing experience and understand your role a little bit better. So we were talking earlier about this experience that you had as a production assistant on
yeah.
MAME as
yep.
a collegiate student. So when was the first time that you kind of had the notion of, this is something I can do, it can be my career?
Oh my gosh.
I'm a producer.
I knew that at 9 years old.
You did?
Yes, I know. People are going to think that's like freaky, but when I was growing up, I was very fortunate. My mom loved the arts. She mm-hmm. took us as kids to ballet, to opera,
Love it.
To theater. And I...
So important.
Somewhere around 9 years old, I discovered that especially plays, especially musicals, have lots of different parts.
Mm-hmm.
They have actors, they have costumes, they have sets, they have lights, they have people in the pit that are playing music. And I just knew, I always knew I couldn't act, and I I can't direct. And I just wanted to be a part of that. And somehow at 9 years old, I said, I didn't know it was called a producer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that's what it did. But I would look at title pages and I would see these great names like David Merrick and Saint Suber. And as, you know, I got a little older, Manny Eisenberg. And to this day, and Hal Prince. And one of my greatest joys is seeing people like Manny, or when I get an email from Hal Prince in the opening of Evita saying congratulations. I mean, it's heartwarming. You know, this is like my heroes.
Wow.
And I remember I would run in, you know, when people used to still take full pages in the New York Times, I'd say, Mom, look, you know, Manny Eisenberg has a new play, or Hal Prince has a new musical. And she'd be like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Who's that?
All right. That's nice. You know, like other kids would like superheroes and stuff.
Oh my gosh.
I knew that. So I didn't know how actually to get to it.
Mm-hmm.
And someday when we have a whole lot more time, I'll tell you all about my Isabel Stevenson. So, because she was a champion of mine, and to her dying day would never admit it. And I know, Julie, she was the little guardian angel sitting on my shoulder. I believe she got me into school. I believe she made a phone call that got me into Columbia. I believe, you know, I just believe there was always Isabel. And we became great friends, which is one of the joys of my career.
Wow.
And I would say this to her, Isabel, okay, you know, it's time to, dear, I don't know what you're talking about. Dear, I just don't. And you could just see that glint in her eye.
Yeah.
But I always knew.
Oh, that is so
knew.
Neat.
Yeah,
that is so neat.
So there is not a day that goes by, even when it gets tough.
Yeah.
You know, producing is tough. Like I said, you know, you're everything and anything. And there are days, like I said, you know, I grab my hair and go, I went to college for this. What am I doing?
Yeah.
But there's not really, same day, I don't pinch myself and say, oh my, I'm doing what I want to do. Which is why I love to be with you, because I know you love it too.
Yeah. Oh, the passion is deep, deep. It's it's part of my DNA.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I know you feel the same way. So take us then to the first show that you are listed on that title page, like all of those heroes.
Jelly's Last Jam.
Okay.
Jelly's Last Jam. My then mentor, I still call her my mentor, is Margot Lyon.
Okay.
I had met Margot. I was working for an off-Broadway theater company that owned, at the time, the Orpheum Theater and the Minetta Lane Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And it's no longer a playhouse anymore, I'm sorry to say, but it was then called the Second Avenue Theater. It's now a movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
And we were producing shows. Some we would bring in, but some we were sort of self-producing to put into our theaters. And in the Minetta Lane, we were doing The Garden of Earthly Delights, which was by Martha Clark,
mm-hmm.
who happens to be Margot's cousin.
Oh.
So I know, right? So we Margot and I became fast friends. And in just conversation, I've said, I've always wanted to produce. I want to do what you're doing. You know, and she said, well, I'm developing this show based on Jelly Roll Morton called Jelly's Last Jam. And I heard it. I'm in. And that was the first one.
Wow. Yeah.
And when we started, we didn't even have Gregory Hines in it yet. It was just Margot had heard in the Smithsonian all the Jelly Roll Morton tapes.
Mm.
You know, he had recorded his.
Oh, how
you know,
fascinating.
Yes. And she decided this would make a fascinating musical. So that's all we really had.
Okay.
And we just started, and she's a great eye for talent. George Wolfe. She picked George Wolfe, who then wrote the book. And, and then Gregory came on board, and it was like a moving, speeding train.
So you were probably learning a lot from her about how to assemble this team
completely,
to get this vision carried out.
Completely.
So as a tip of the hat to Hal Luftig's first official producing credit, here's music from Jelly's Last Jam.
Listen, people, here comes Dr. Jam. He's got glory all around him, yes he has. And when the world goes wrong, you got the blues. He's the man what makes you get out both your dancing shoes. Yes, he has. Ain't no medicine known to man can make you feel good like the doctor can.
you need to know.
World's greatest one-man show.
Even the devil, whoever he was, couldn't play jazz the way Jerry does.
Ripping through you right down to your soul. So spread the word wherever you may go. You've seen the light tonight, now you know. Blaze his name across the sky, flaming letters 10 feet high. J.R. Morgan, Dr. Jazz.
Producer Hal Luftig in the studio at Sirius XM on Broadway. That was music from Jelly's Last Jam, one of his first big producing credits. And so then take us, Hal, to the point where then you're the one who is really lead producing. You're choosing the show, you're choosing the concept, and you're the one assembling the team.
Well,
when did that start to happen?
The first lead producing thing I did was Thoroughly Modern Millie. And that's a cute story too.
Yeah.
I was invited to a reading in some person's apartment on Park Avenue, you know, when you get these invites, and usually they're at, you know, 42nd Street Studio.
Uh-huh.
This was like a home address.
Mm-hmm.
And I went because Dick Scanlon, who
yes.
I sort of briefly met in, you know,
he's so smart.
Yeah, oh my God, he's
funny
so smart
and talented.
And funny. And right. And so he like caught me on the street and said, I'm doing this reading, please come, and sent me, you know, an invitation. And I went, and it was, like I said, in this person's apartment.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, Dick Scanlon was doing the writing.
Yes, doing the writing.
Yeah.
And he's also the book writer now of Motown.
Aha.
So a little plug for Motown.
Yeah.
And I went, and Michael Mayer, who I had not met, the whole show was done by Michael Mayer, and Dick Scanlon played all the parts. He was Mrs. Mears. He was Millie. He was Trevor Graydon.
Oh, to be a fly on that wall.
Oh, Julie. One of the things that I keep threatening him is I'm going to produce.
He's going to do it.
He's going to do it as a show. It was the most entertaining thing I've ever seen in my life. And I got a call afterwards, what do you think? And mm-hmm. I said, you know what? I was so charmed, I'm in.
Yeah.
So I did that with Fox Theatrical, Kristen mm-hmm. Caskey and Mike Isaacson. That was my first work with them, one of my favorite people on the earth. And we went to La Jolla and mm-hmm. we did it out there and we developed it. And it was really, you know, sometimes the theater gods speak.
Yep.
So we were producing at the time. I was one of the producers of Annie Get Your Gun, the revival mm-hmm. that was kind of winding down. And we weren't sure how long it was going to run. And there comes a point in a production schedule where you have to say, okay, look, if you're going to open in the fall,
mm-hmm.
you have to start building costumes and sets and advertising
sure.
and all those kinds of things. We had missed that date. It was sort of like mid-July, and we're talking about 2011. And we kind of had missed the date. And I'll never forget, I had to like very sort of brokenheartedly tell Michael Mayer, the director,
mm-hmm.
Michael, we just can't do it the fall. We're not gonna get there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we had to start building the sets, and Annie Get Your Gun is continuing to run, and you know, God love Jimmy Niedlander, he's not gonna kick us out. You know, and I was
yeah.
a little conflicted because
yeah.
I was one of the producers of that too. And around the first week in August, you know, Barry Weisler decided, you know what, we're not gonna make it through the fall. Let's just run to Labor Day like most shows and close. So Jimmy Niedlander then called and said, you know, can you get in, you know, in the fall? And
mm-hmm.
I just said, Jimmy, I just can't. It's just, you know, we would be pushing it. And I
yeah.
don't know if the sets would be right and advertising. All that. And so, you know, he, you know, was very disappointed. And then 9/11 happened.
Mm.
And I thought, wow, that's, you know.
This is 2001 we're
right,
talking about.
Right, 2001, okay. Yes. I'm sorry, yeah. What did I say, 2011? 2001,
yeah,
sorry.
Too many ones.
Sorry, yeah, yeah. See, that's what happens.
One too many ones.
And it was like, wow, you know. And it was so weird because I was so heartbroken.
Yeah.
And I was trying to, when that we couldn't come in the fall, and I was trying to sort of patch things up with Michael, yeah, and, you know, kind of make it okay. And it's a thing a producer does, you know.
Sure.
Just says, that's part of his job. So Michael and I were out on Fire Island. I'd taken him out. We were sharing a weekend, mm-hmm, house, and we were out there after Labor Day, and
oh,
when it happened.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah. Ugh. Talk about a bonding experience,
oh,
huh?
Oh, yeah.
So that was my first.
And had that happened in the fall, the show probably wouldn't have survived.
Remember?
Because it was such a tough time.
A lot of shows, if you look back on that.
Yeah.
Not for the lack that they were not fabulous shows.
It had nothing to do with the shows. Just no one was coming to New York for a while.
No one was coming to New York.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
No one was coming to New York.
Oh, my goodness.
You just couldn't, you know, people needed to get paid. And
Thoroughly Modern Millie has so much good, I feel like so much good heart and energy around it. There are so many lovely stories, you know. Yeah. Mark Kudish helped. Cheyenne Jackson had just arrived in town and he, like, you know, introduced him to his agent.
Right.
And so there wasn't.
Sutton Foster.
Yes, please.
Can we just say the SF word?
The
please?
SF.
That girl came from the
chorus.
And to this day, you know, I have to say, if she's listening, she's probably going to hate me for this, but I can't not look at her and think, there's my little girl.
Absolutely.
There's my little girl.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that put her on the map.
Well,
and for anyone who doesn't know,
are
you okay, you know, describing that just a little bit? Seth talks about it a lot,
yeah,
but, you know, she was in the ensemble.
She was in the ensemble. She, you know, we were having auditions to go to La Jolla,
mm-hmm,
and Sutton came in and, you know, she had a great voice and she, you know, but she didn't at the time, I'm going to be completely candid here. She didn't dress of that world. I,
mm-hmm,
remember she came in, you know, her hair was parted in the middle and she was very straight.
She's kind of tomboyish in
right,
real life.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's, thank you.
Even
that's
though she looks so glamorous.
That's when that girl glams up, boy, shoot, no one more.
Yeah.
And so we kept thinking, God, she's like, sounds great. And, but what, you know, and Michael finally said, you know what, we're going to figure something out, but we're going to get her. Let's nail her down, put her in the ensemble. And we were in rehearsal and in La Jolla. I wasn't there. I was actually, you know, back on the East Coast. And the girl who was to play Millie had vocal mode, mm-hmm, problems and needed to go on vocal, mm-hmm, rest. Well, you have to keep rehearsing.
Of course you
know,
you do.
The clock doesn't stop, you know, especially when you're a regional theater, you know, tickets have been sold, you're in.
Yeah.
So they put Sutton with a book just to finish the blocking, mm-hmm, just to finish. And I'll never forget, I got a call from Michael Mayer and he said, oh, hell, you need to come out here.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, so, and I said, Michael, stop, stop. You know what? One day's rehearsal does not, you know, I mean, stop.
Not a leading lady make.
Make, yeah. I'm not getting on a plane and flying across the country because, you know, and tomorrow, yeah. So the next day, still on vocal rest, mm-hmm, Sutton, you know, did it again. Now I get a call from Dick Scanlon, who said, Al, you got to come out here.
She did it better than me.
She did it better. Right. You thought you loved me. You got to see this. And it kept going on, like, by the third or fourth day. And it became clear that we weren't, the Millie of our, you know, had to be on vocal rest for a while. So sure enough, we came out and Sutton just threw herself into it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the first time in my career you watched literally like a star being born.
Wow.
I'll never forget when Janine and Dick wrote that song, Gimme Gimme.
Yeah.
The first time they played it, it was in the lobby of the La Jolla Playhouse.
Mm.
Sutton standing around, you know, the piano, sheet reading it,
mm-hmm,
and nailed it. And just like everybody just stopped in their tracks, like, you know, people cleaning the theater and ushers and people went, and you just knew.
Wow, you just gave me the chills.
You just knew. You just knew. And you know, she opened on Broadway and she, you know, we opened, everybody got nominated, she won. And it was so wonderful. But talk about being prepared.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, that
you know, that's what they always say. And I think I feel it's more true every day. Yeah. It's like preparation meets timing, meets luck. And, you know, it all has to conspire together.
And she just, she like was shot out of a cannon.
Wow.
And it.
Yeah. And she's been, you know, just on fire on the scene ever since. Yeah. Here's that very song. Gimme, Gimme from Tony winner Sutton Foster.
Simple choice, nothing more. This or that, either or. Marry well, social world, businessman, clever girl. Or pin my future on a green glass love. What kind of life am I dreaming of? I say, gimme, 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 that thing called love. I want it, gimme, gimme, that thing thing called love. I need it, highs and lows, tears and laughter. Gimme happy ever after. Gimme, gimme that thing called love. Gimme, gimme
Sutton Foster on Broadway. I'm with producer Hal Luftig, who did that show and so many of our other most memorable moments on Broadway. Seussical, I love the great Aarons and Flaherty, or you know, just so incredible. Yeah. And you've done Legally Blonde and most recently Kinky Boots, and you've got a couple of other exciting things coming up. Tell us, you just got back from the West Coast.
I just got back from San Diego, where we did at the Old Globe a production of The Last Goodbye, which is Romeo and Juliet told with the music of Jeff Buckley.
I mean, that's just incredible right there.
Yeah. You know, the fit of his music and his lyrics with the story of R&J, you know, his music is very, you know, about unrequited love and loneliness and soul searching and
achingly, you know, beautiful.
Achingly, yeah. And it was great. It was, you know, I, like I said earlier, I'm a big believer in getting things on their feet,
mm-hmm.
you know, looking at it, being able to see it, you know, and see where it stands, where
Absolutely.
It doesn't, you know. So that was really great. And
yeah.
at the same time, Evita's on its U.S. tour.
Yes.
So I got to go up and see some of them. In fact, you know, the girl playing Ava Perón was
from
the
Kinky Boots.
Yes.
Caroline
Bowman.
Bowman.
That's, you know, another cute. She,
yeah.
you know, she, you know, I think when you audition for a role in the ensemble, it's a different kind of audition. You know,
mm-hmm.
you come in, you sing 16 bars, you know, can you move? Can you sing? Can you, you know, and,
mm-hmm.
and Carolyn certainly nailed that part. And then we were casting for the role of Ava Perón. And Bernie Telsey, you know, you go in as a producer again,
mm-hmm.
you let people do their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't like micromanage. And I go to the final auditions and I look down the list and I see Carolyn Bowman. And, you know, I know actors go from show to show. I mean,
of
come
course.
On, they're not going to stay with me forever. So, but she walked in the room and saw me sitting there, and poor thing turned white as a sheet.
Oh.
White as a sheet. And I would say it, but we're on radio. Can't. She did something. I think she did something else too. And I just went up to her. I said, Carolyn, it's okay. Stop. It's okay. Of course, it's okay. And she sang, and I'm telling you, it was like
that
the Sutton
role,
Foster.
Come song. On.
She nailed it. And I sit and I watch her. You know, you have to remember, the girl who's playing Ava Perón goes from a 16-year-old
yes.
to a 33-year-old dying of ovarian cancer. So it's not like, you know, there's like a huge arc there.
Right.
And she nails it. So I was up there in, I was in Los Angeles for the LA opening, and I was so proud of her.
That's
so
great.
Her. So
That's great.
Great.
And you have yeah. Here Lies Love,
and,
too.
And we're trying to move Here Lies Love, which I, did you see it?
I didn't. And that's why I made that
gee.
Noise, because I'm like, I didn't. And
it
so
is,
it's got to get there
is,
so I can, because I heard just
the
most remarkable things.
Thing. It's the conceit of it by David Byrne and directed by Alex Timbers. Is, you know, it's the story of Imelda Marcos,
mm-hmm.
not about the shoes, forget that, but about the about her relationship to Ferdinand and how they came to rule. And it's sort of very Eva Perón-like
mm-hmm.
about these, you know, this populist ruler
mm-hmm.
who did do really good things. And she did really bad things. And you know, there's it doesn't take sides. It just tells that story. It doesn't, you don't walk out going, oh, she was horrible, just like Eva Perón.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they did do really good things. And, but yet, you're in a disco, and the actors move through you, around
yeah.
you, and you move around as these platforms move, and they become different, you know, parts of the stage. And then every so often you start disco dancing, because Imelda loved to dance. That was her whole thing. She would
this
come.
This is so cool.
She
oh, my
would,
gosh.
She would come to Studio 54 in there, and it's a multimedia show, so there is actual footage and
yeah.
photos of her dancing with Yasser Arafat and Ronald Reagan
oh
and Andy Warhol. I mean, that was what she loved to do. So it's a really cool show.
Yeah.
And we are trying to find a place for it.
Yeah.
Because it's tough.
Well, because, you know, this came up with Lea Salonga. It's not just a theater being open. Right now, there are basically no open theaters on Broadway,
yeah.
but it's got to be the right theater
well,
for
because,
the right piece.
Yeah, you've got to be able to move around,
mm-hmm.
and there's it needs just as much room backstage
mm-hmm.
as it does front stage, because the crew is constantly moving
yeah.
these platforms and moving people and it you know having all this multimedia the videos and the disco balls it's,
yeah
it's so so
and how
cool.
What do you think of this, you know, this is a little bit the new trend with what we're calling immersive theater
yeah.
where there's a lot more interactive experience going on and
yeah.
you're not just sitting in a seat looking at a proscenium with a fourth wall, so to speak. You're much more engaged, and the show is maybe going around you.
Yeah.
Natasha Pierre and The Great Comet of 1812 is doing that. We have the Sleep No More
right.
at the McKittrick, which is a Macbeth-ish
right.
telling,
no,
but it's,
right.
you know, you're in the show, sort of. Here Lies Love
yeah.
is also happening all around you. What do you make of that from your perspective?
I think it's cool. I think it doesn't work for everything.
Uh-huh.
But when it does work, it's kind of cool. Because,
yeah.
you know, I think theater just it unites people,
mm-hmm.
which is why I think, you know, it's different when you're in a theater than when you're in a, you know, when you're watching a movie or a film or
mm-hmm.
anything like that, because you're watching live people do something live, obviously, with other people around you,
mm-hmm.
your audience members. And there's a
there's an exchange.
There's an exchange. There's a total exchange. And the people on stage are talking to you in the audience, and you're talking to your neighbor and all. So when the piece is right
mm-hmm.
and you actually get up and get to move with those people, And in Here Lies Love, that's what was just so, you know, amazing. You're jumping up and you're just going, you don't know the person on your left is. And in fact, they tell you at the beginning of the show, you're probably, because you're all
moving
around, you're going to get separated.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Don't cling on to the person you came with.
Yeah.
You know, I love
that about Sleep No More, too. Yeah. They kind of try to break you up from the person that you're with. And I find that if you can get over your nervousness about that, you actually have a much better experience because you're not worrying about anybody else.
Yeah.
You're just going and having your own experience. And then you get to compare notes later, which is so cool.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, when we went to see Natasha in the comic, you sit at tables. So you're now with other people and you're eating with other people. I went there and we were somewhere. I think we were on the Cape and somebody came up to us and said, "Hi, how are you?" And I was good. And, you know, and finally, you know, they walked away and I said to my husband, "Who was that?" I thought he knew them. And he said, "Those were the people we were."
Oh,
Natasha.
How interesting.
And I thought, that is
there
great. Talk about bonding in a theatrical setting. You
absolutely.
Know, so it doesn't work for everything, but when it works, I mean, I wouldn't see, like, I don't know, Hello, Dolly is an immersive.
Maybe you're at the Harmonia Gardens
and everyone's running around.
The waiters are coming around you. I don't know. We're with producer Hal Luftig. It is so fun to talk to you about the business of musical theater and plays and producing. And so one of the things that I'm the most curious about is how you make those instinctive judgment calls where you're in the business of having to choose what's going to really a gamble of what's going to make it. And one of the themes that comes up on this show again and again is how there is no formula.
Right.
You can have everything in the world going for you. It just seems like on paper that it's the best team, it's the best cast, and it's the best idea. And then poof, it can all go away.
Yeah.
So
it's, you know, Jeanine Tesori, who wrote Thoroughly Modern Millie, amongst other things, said to me once, "Honey, it's all alchemy." You know, it's alchemy and there's a lot of it we can't control.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes, you know, there are things about it you can control. Like if a thing is running wildly over budget or, you know, how you advertise it. But sometimes it's not always about the what, it's about the when.
Mm.
And you can't
The timing.
Right.
Just when a show lands and what else it's up against at the time can have everything to do with how it goes.
Exactly. Or, you know, I love Chicago, but this is a great example. You know, Chicago happened in 1975. Pretty much the same show.
Yeah.
You know,
Pretty much the same show.
It opened against this little thing called a chorus line, you know, and it ran and it had a couple of things. You know, it had a big star, Gwen Verdon, and then she got sick and they put Liza in there. And, you know, now fast forward, they do it at Encores and it's right on the heels of now we take Court TV but it was the first time we had ever seen really Court TV in the OJ trial.
Yeah.
I mean, I would come home and I would I would watch that trial like I was watching a soap opera.
Absolutely.
Except it was real. Two people were dead and, you know, we're all like watching this thing. And Chicago was revived and it was exactly what that trial was like, that we take these trials as entertainment.
Right.
Murder as entertainment.
Right.
It was just in the right place at the right time. I'm not saying it's not a brilliant show.
Right.
It was just a brilliant 1975.
Yeah. One time it didn't work, you know, or very short lived.
Right.
And now the revival is going strong at 17
years.
Still.
It's almost older than I am, if you can believe that. But it was the timing. It's sometimes you can't control it. It's about the when. And that's
what's just as heartbreaking when, you know, the director, Jeff Calhoun, said to me once, you know, you care just as much about a flop.
Oh, my gosh. Sometimes even more.
Even more.
Sometimes even more because you know, it's a wounded child.
Yeah.
And you're like, I can make this work. I know
I can
do
it.
You can walk, Billy. You can walk. Just, you know, and you just can't figure out why. And it's just. It's heartbreaking. I mean, there were times, and I'm not going to lie, as a producer, I won't say which, but, you know, that you look at it and you go, you know, this ain't going to make it.
Yeah.
Let's just shoot the horse and let's move on. But the ones that you believe in and you work so hard and all the signs, you have the best team and you have the best thing, and, you know, and they just can't catch fire. And you spend, you know, much more energy trying to, you know, fan it. rather than, you know, the ones that, it works. And it's just as hard. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah. What's the one that got away?
Wicked. I say it. I say it to David Stone is a dear friend, and I you know, we laugh about it all the time now because I just, you know, when I saw Wicked, in all fairness, I'm going to defend myself for a second. When I first came into contact with Wicked, it was a different show.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot
they
more.
They changed it a lot.
Oh, a huge amount. But when I, there was a lot more talking animals and Dr. Dillamount was a much bigger role and Elphaba a much smaller role. And there was, you know, if I remember correctly, it was, you know, it, and I just thought, wow, you know, listen, we all
I'm
know.
Not feeling no, this
I'm
one.
Not feeling this one. And, you know, David, I'm sorry, I'm going to pass. And, you know, it was, and he's a good friend. And I've done every, I've been part of just even in investing or whatever in all of his shows because they think he has such impeccable taste. And that one got away. You know, you can't, you could just, you know, yeah.
I know that these shows, you know, I think there's like 25 of them. It's over 20. On the on this incredible rap sheet from the Broadway Internet database. But and I know they must be sort of be like your children.
Oh,
so
are.
I would be asking you to choose a favorite child, which you probably can't do. But I'll maybe I'll go this way. Proudest moment.
Well, besides the one right now, the which I'm proud.
So
you know what?
Sweet.
I'm proud of it because, like you said earlier in the program, you stand in the back and you watch. It just it says just, you know, yourself with dignity.
Yeah.
Be yourself with dignity. And I think more than ever now, with all this bullying going on and all of this crazy, I couldn't be a kid today with all of that. So I am so happy that there's something out there for these kids that just say, you know, just who cares?
Yeah.
Be yourself and
be
do it with
yourself.
Dignity. That
change the world when you change your mind.
That's right.
And I also love talk about timing. You know, I mean, I've seen Kinky Boots a proud three times, and I don't see shows very more than once very often, and so it's been delightful every time. There's such joy. But, you know, I'm looking at these like Midwest ladies looking at the drag queens and like it's the right time.
Yeah.
Everybody's ready. My mom is like, are we going? You know, it's the right time for this message and everybody's
and
ready
for
it.
That's what I said earlier. You know, it's the right it's alchemy. You know, if we would have done Kinky Boots 6 years earlier.
Yeah. No way.
I don't know. People were so, I don't know what would have happened. So that one I'm most, and the other one that I always, that I just, it's a just a beacon in my life is Moving Out.
Oh.
I would go and watch that, you know, those dance. I fell in
like
love with
nothing like that had ever been done like
before,
that before.
And since. And it was just gorgeous storytelling through this incredible dance that she created with this great music, Billy Joel. I mean, you know.
Great music. Michael Kavanaugh. Is that his name?
Yes.
Oh, he is. He
was,
an,
you know,
incredible
and those
performer.
Dancers, I mean, they would, you know, Liz Parkinson and John Celia and Kareen. And they would like throw each other around that stage and just be, it was just, my jaw never stopped dropping. I would see that every, at least twice a week.
Whoa.
I would just stand in the back of the theater, just go pop in and go.
So. Well, I could go on and on.
I could too. You know what? I got to tell you something. Like I said, you are on this and skydiving. And honey, I am not skydiving. So as far as I'm concerned, my bucket list is she could be complete now. I so thank you.
It is a privilege and a pleasure. I'm so happy that that this show, Kinky Boots, brought us together. And not only is it, you know, one of your proudest moments in a long and wonderful career, but it gave us a reason to meet and to talk. And for that, I am very grateful.
Me too. And let's not wait till we have to speed date again.
Okay. No. We'll make that good.
Okay.
And I just always feel like I'm an ambassador for my listeners.
Oh,
so for all of those memorable moments that people have experienced on stage because of you, I thank you on all of our behalf. If we didn't have you, we wouldn't have this long list of
20. Okay, see, you're going to get me crying again. Every time I see you, you get me crying. Now just stop it. Stop.
Hal Luftig, thank you.
You're welcome.
moving out.
Thanks so much for listening to this week's Broadway Names with Julie James on SiriusXM on Broadway. And I absolutely love hearing from my fellow theater fans across the country. So please connect with me. I'm chirping away on Twitter. That's Julie_James. It's great hearing from so many of you there. You can also find me on Facebook. That's facebook.com/fansofjuliejames. I've got great pictures and stuff there. And you can always drop me a good old email. That address is juliejames@siriusxm.com. And I invite you to join me again Saturdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, Sundays at noon, Thursday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern, and now anytime on demand. That way you can listen on apps or online at your convenience. So I will see you next time for more Broadway Names with Julie James. Thanks for listening.
The choice was mine and mine completely. I could have any prize that I desired. I could burn with the splendor of the brightest fire. Or else I could choose time. Remember, I was very young then, and a year was forever and a day. So what use could 50, 60, 70 be? I saw the lights and I was on my way. And how I lived, how I shone, but how soon the lights were gone. The choice was mine and no one else's. I could have the millions at my feet, give my life to people I might never meet, or else to children of my own. Remember, I was very young then, thought I needed the numbers on my side, thought the more that loved me, the more loved I'd be. But such things cannot be multiplied. Oh, my daughter, oh, my son, understand what I have done.
Money was raised and a tomb was built, a monument to Evita. Only the pedestal was completed, and Evita's body disappeared for 17 years.